It ain't easy being a new filmmaker these days. First, there's the money. Then you have to assemble a crew. Of course, you need actors. And if all that's not difficult enough, then you have demons trying to kill you, or a serial killer who gets you involved in his gleeful crime spree. What's an artist to do? Sounds like it's time for episode 67 of Pop Art, the podcast where my guest chooses a movie from popular culture, and I'll select a film from the more art classic indie side of cinema with a connection to it. I am your Usually I start the month with a postman host, Howard Kasner. Today, I am happy to welcome as my guest for the Pop Art Halloween episode, teacher by day or aficionado by night, and someone who makes a career of being on other people's podcasts, as well as being a podcaster herself, Lisa Leahy.
Hi, Howard. Thanks for having me today.
Lisa has chosen as her selection the horror found footage film Hell House, LLC, while I have chosen the Belgian dark comedy found footage film Man Bites Dog. Both films about documentarians who discover their subject matter is a little more than they bargained for. Before beginning, I do want to encourage my listeners to follow, like, or comment on the podcast. I want to know what you think. To begin, Lisa, why don't you tell our audience something about yourself?
As you said, I am a high school English teacher. I'm currently in my 22nd year of teaching. I don't know how it got to be that number, but it is. I've always been a fan of films since I was very young, and my father would show me various films. My earliest film memory is of watching Star Wars on the floor of our den, falling in love with the sound the stormtroopers made when they ran. Very excited to have gotten into this network of podcasting, to have made many friends along the way, and it's really exciting to get to show up and talk about various films with various kinds of people. It's been a fantastic way to spend the past couple of years, especially during a pandemic.
True that. Well, with that, let's get to your selection, and that is Hell House, LLC. First, some information about the film. Hell House, LLC is an American found footage horror film released in 2015. It was directed and written by Stephen Cognetti. It stars Ryan Jennifer, Danny Bellini, Gore Abrams, Jared Hacker, Adam Schneider, Alice Balke, Phil Hess, Lauren A. Kennedy, and Jeb Krieger. In the year 2009, a group of friends get together in a small New York town to turn the Abaddon Hotel, a hotel with a checkered past, into a Halloween haunted house. But the night of the opening, 15 people, tour goers, and staff died. No one knows why. So in 2014, a filmmaking crew travels to the town to make a documentary about the situation and hopefully discover what really happened. What could possibly go wrong? Before getting into the film, I thought we would talk a little about found footage films in general. How do you define a found footage film?
My experience with found footage films are the films that were recorded by the characters as the events were happening, and then these films, quote unquote, put together as a result of the footage that was found either on a camera. Lately, there's a new twist on the found footage. Some of these are on computer screens, edited together as a way to put out there into the world the truth about something that has happened.
It should be noted that the definition of found footage film has actually changed from the original conception. Originally, a found footage film was a movie made up of found footage, not recreated footage, but real footage the filmmaker found and put together. The one I remember, and I actually could be a little wrong about this because I couldn't find as much information about it again as when I first saw it, and this was the 1980s, was a film from the Philippines called Perfume Nightmare, about a jeepney driver obsessed with space travel and the West, but when he goes to Paris, he becomes disillusioned. But it's all original footage. It's nothing that the filmmaker actually shot or recreated. And it was actually very interesting. Martin Scorsese gave it a distribution in the U.S. But over time, it's completely changed into your definition.
Interesting. It's funny because I think if you say found footage to most people, they're going to go where I do, because I think they see it as a horror trope now.
Also, the technique of found footage could say it began in literature, in novels that are made up of letters or diaries that are found by somebody else. And these are novels like Dracula and Frankenstein.
For sure.
The first found footage film, or at least the first horror found footage film, is generally considered to be Italian director Ruggero Deodato's Cannibal Holocaust in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
But then, it really took off with 1999's The Blair Witch Project.
Absolutely.
This might be an interesting quote for you to respond to. In reviewing VHS, which is another found footage film, for the AV Club, Scott Tobia notes that the genre has since become to the noughts and the teens what slasher movies were to the 80s. What do you think that is?
I think it's because we are very much a self-centered society now. I mean, the 90s, there was the beginning of it because you had a number of amateur filmmakers with the advent of the home camcorder. Obviously, it started mostly with VHS tapes and home movies, finding this black tape that somebody forgot to label and popping it in and seeing who knows could be on there, which is where the VHS anthologies jump off from in the realm of snuff films and that kind of thing. But I think where it has definitely evolved is in this idea of social media, where we all have a camcorder in our pockets now with the cell phones, and so much of what we do as a collective, not necessarily me personally, is take pictures and document our lives on the regular and put it out there for everyone to see. So I think this idea of going out there and being an amateur filmmaker themselves, the 90s, when people really started to grasp it as, yeah, this is something you could do, and more independent filmmakers being able to release their own stories, people really gravitated toward this idea of, well, I can do that. And it became less about the effects and more about conflict and story. You didn't have to worry about what it looked like, because the whole purpose behind found footage is that it's supposed to look gritty and amateur.
I think you make a lot of very good points there. Yes, the 90s was the beginning of the really big independent movie. You know, you have Tarantino and the Coen brothers and Spike mm-hmm. Lee, Kevin Smith. And then once you get into the noughts, and especially the teens, you then have equipment that is so inexpensive
mm-hmm.
that anybody can now make film. I used to joke with friends, once the 90s started, the great thing about it was that anybody could make a film. The bad thing about it is that anybody could make a film.
Absolutely.
Why did you choose this film?
Being the Halloween episode, being the horror fan, I like to try and, I guess, show my street cred a bit. I didn't want to choose something that I thought was super familiar to everyone. I try and choose something that might be a little lesser known. Horror fans, I think, know this film pretty darn well. It's very popular. There have been two sequels. There's a pseudo prequel coming. This is a film I think I first discovered on Shudder, which is a streaming service of just horror movies, and it's such an exceptional service for the price as well, because it really digs into every last corner of horror. As I am always drawn to haunted house films, especially the fact that this was a haunted house found footage film, I leapt on it. And I love it. It's absolutely one of my favorites. I have a friend that I turned on to, and she and I are kind of ravenous for this one and the second film. So when the third one was coming, we were just as excited about it as everyone else. I don't think it reaches the level that the first two did. I love the fact that you can do something so effective with such a simple format for not a lot of money and not a lot of effects. I don't have a problem with gore, but I don't need that Grand Guignol horrifying to look at horror. I want something that's going to get under my skin. And there are a couple of moments in this particular film that are done so well. You have me captivated for the entirety of the film.
I first saw it this week in preparation for the show. I may have heard of it before. I'm just not sure. But I found it to be very well made, often clever and smart, and more often terrifying. I'm going, clowns. Why do they always choose clowns? I think it is in many ways very well made. In fact, I think it is so well made that it makes you not ask certain questions and hides the fact that there are some plot and other issues going on. What are some of your favorite scenes?
The scene that definitely got me was the scene when the character Paul is in his bedroom. He's frequently the one behind the camera. He wakes up and he's facing the camera, but we can see behind him sitting on the floor this very creepy looking young lady. First of all, to wake up and there's somebody just sitting there in your room is unnerving as it is. But when he notices her, he pulls the sheets over his head, and that's the worst because now you know something something is happening outside of that sheet, and neither Paul nor we can see what it is. He pulls the sheet down, and she's looking at him. Just as he pulls the sheet up, you see her move, and it's like, oh, God, here it comes. He waits under that sheet for just long enough that you are ready to tear the sheet off yourself. And, of course, when he pulls the sheet down, she's right there, jumps at him, the whole thing. It's on par with the shower scene. When you're in bed, you're vulnerable. When you're in the shower, you're vulnerable.
I assume that everybody is like me when they were young. And if you think something is in the room, I mean, when you're 5 or 6 or whatever, somehow if you pull the sheet over your head, it can't harm you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why we think that when we're that young, but that's what I would do. I would pull the sheet over my head and magically I knew that nothing could harm me. But he doesn't scream out for help.
Right.
He pulls the sheet over his head just like we would do when we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite scenes, the standout for me, is when Paul is going through the hotel and he gets to the entrance to the basement,
mm-hmm.
turns, and the clown is just standing there. That was just absolutely terrifying. No one can explain it.
So, mention the head turns. He sees the clown looking down toward the basement and he looks back and now the head has turned toward him.
Right. I thought of another clever plot to turn was the use of the room number 2C where Sarah says, I'm in 2C.
Mm-hmm.
I think just before this, when they finished the interview and she says, I want to rest, is when it dawned on me that Sarah wasn't alive.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, we only have her word that she was staying with her family.
Right.
We don't really know.
Reached out to them.
Right.
They didn't locate her for this interview.
Which we'll get into because, as I said, I think there are some plot issues and some things about the whole plot that aren't really believable or don't
sure.
make a lot of sense. When they got back to the hotel, I remembered that the rooms had letters
mm-hmm.
on their numbers. So I knew what was going to happen, which was good. Sometimes I like being ahead of the story.
That's good.
And in this case, I was. When it comes to Hell House LLC, and we'll get into this a little more later, the main critical complaints about it is that the ending is a bit of a letdown, which I think yes and no. And the acting could be better. But what do you think of the director, Stephen Cognetti?
I'm happy with what he's put together here. I think he's put together, as also one of the writers, characters that are very intriguing. There are definitely scenes where you can tell they're sort of improvising back and forth. But I think that he did a great job in structuring the story. I like the frame story of it. I like that it's not simply about the Hell House footage, that it starts as an open documentary, releasing the information about the Hell House footage. So I liked the dynamics of the various characters. The acting of the, let's say, specialists, the journalist who took the photos initially, and this gentleman with the wonderfully waxed mustache, they're space filler to me. They're the exposition. They're the people in Burkittsville that are interviewed in the Blair Witch Project before they get into the woods. I kind of was like, okay, I see what function you serve. You're not what I'm here for, so let's keep going. I don't fault Cognetti for them, though. They kind of have to be there.
Well, I think that's very true because it's part of the story and part of the setup. What I like about it is how he, along with the cinematographer, they convincingly blend in different styles of filmmaking to create the film.
Mm-hmm.
The televised news reports really look like televised news reports. You have the interviews with the people you were talking about. You have the film recorded by the people opening the space, which is the majority of it, mm-hmm. which looks different than the handheld camera from the tour goer.
Right. The YouTube video, the cell phone video. Definitely.
It's all very well mimicked. It's all very well put together. But you bring up an interesting point in that you have these other people, like the people they are interviewing to get background. This leads to an issue that I sometimes see in found footage films, and this does get to the screenplay. One thing that often found footage films leave out is who actually made the film,
mm-hmm.
because it's all found footage. So it's not the people who recorded the original films who made the film. They're more often dead.
Mm-hmm.
So someone else had to come along and make this film and put it all together into one film. Now, in the Blair Witch Project, it's very clever. They just say right up front, we don't know who did this. And that's mm-hmm. a perfectly acceptable answer. But here, we don't really know who put it together and why. I guess we assume it's the documentarian's assistant who is going through those.
Right, the guy who was left behind.
Right. And then he got the final bits of the video when the police went to find the documentarian and the cameraman at the hotel. But we really don't know who this person is or why he put it together or why he put it together the way he is. I must say that he's very good at editing it all together into a very interesting and comprehensive whole. But in many of these found footage films, I'm going, we'll actually get to this on Man Bites Dog.
Yeah.
Who actually put this film together and why? And that often gets left out. The screenplay, which was also Cognetti, how do you feel about the screenplay?
I like it. Some of the issues that you bring up, there's sort of things that I'm willing to accept as a horror fan, the suspension of disbelief. I remember having students when the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the 2003 version, came out. In the beginning, it talks about this is actual footage the police officers took when they went into the house thing, and there's actual photographs. And I remember telling students who were like, yeah, but did you see it's real footage? I went, nobody is going to release actual crime scene stuff for a mass market audience to go to a movie and pay $12 to see. So when I watch these films, I just release that and I say, I'm willing to pretend this is what happened here. This is how this movie came to be. So it's funny that that's a question that you're looking at here. And it did occur to me with Man Bites Dog. But with this one, it's not something I've ever sat and thought about.
Even though I have these questions, they almost never bother me in watching the film, if the film is good. Like I said,
sure,
the movie is so clever and well done that it makes you not think about certain issues. But it's like zombie films. The more zombie films you watch, the more you start thinking, well, wait a minute.
Yes, exactly.
But if the film is good, I'm generally not going to ask that question, at least at the time. Only when I get to a podcast.
Absolutely.
But one of the other issues is we don't get a full understanding of what happened in Hell House when there's no reason that we shouldn't get it. For example, how did the people die in the basement?
Are you asking me, or is this rhetorical?
Well, it's both, I guess. The police would know. They would bring the bodies out, and they would run an investigation on it, and they would know how these people died. We know how one died. He cut his throat.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing else is mentioned as to how the others died. I did read this one thing that actually doesn't help things. It actually makes it a little worse. Is that at the beginning of the movie, you hear the 911 call.
Right.
Where the woman is calling in hysteric, but her voice is muffled, and you really only hear they're into the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But if you listen closely, apparently she says, they're pulling us into the wall.
Yes.
It suggests that Andrew Tully's portal to hell work. And it explains they have these creepy outline of faces and hands seen in the wall. But if that's what's happening, then how does anybody know how many people died?
Right. This 15 number, you mean, right?
Right. They say they know how many because that's how many they saw when they went in the basement and brought the bodies out.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going into the wall, no matter what she says, or they would have been in the wall. It would be impossible to keep that quiet. Sarah suggested that there's some sort of police. You're not going to be able to cover that up. There are too many people who died with too many families from outside that city are going to say no. And the reporters are going to say, give us this information. And there's no real reason not to give them that information.
Well, I would argue that that's just a line Sarah gives. I don't think she believes it at all. She's using it as a way to lure the documentarians into the hotel so they can get more people.
Oh, I agree. I actually think it's very clever when she says the police don't want this information out. And here are the videos. They ask, why didn't you give it to the police? Well, you'll find out at the end. And very cleverly, you find out it has nothing to do with the police.
Nothing at all. She's like, I got to it first. There's a great line, I thought. She says, well, have you gone to the hotel? And the documentarian says something along the lines of, oh, yeah, it was locked, or, oh, we couldn't get permission. And Sarah says to her, was that all that's stopping you? It's such a good line.
But at this point, why? No, why does Sarah lure them?
That goes more into the whole thing of what Andrew Tully had been doing and these weird cloaked figures who keep showing up and this weird portal to hell that shows up that Melissa appears to be dragged into during the chaos of everything. It's interesting because this number 15 doesn't sit for me. So it makes me think that these were tour goers that were left behind or potentially were trampled in the panic.
But that's basically what I mean. I would assume that a lot of them were trampled on the way to get out.
Yeah.
But there's no reason that the new documentarians
wouldn't know that.
Yeah, that would be
true. News.
And I don't think that quite works for me.
We just need more clowns.
Yes. But one other thing is that I actually thought that the Halloween exhibit, where people go in to see, wasn't that interesting.
No, it wasn't.
I thought one of the tour goers who were filming it, the YouTube one, said, this is kind of lame.
Yes.
I was disappointed in that. I would think that after doing a couple of Halloween houses, they would have known what to do to scare people, but we don't get a good idea of what makes this Hell House so scary.
I absolutely agree.
That people would pay money to go in.
And as somebody who worked in these houses, in Rhode Island, we have one called the Haunted Labyrinth that's been going for years. It's run by a CYO center, actually, like a religious group center. And it's one of the best ones because they keep changing it and they update it. But you need a lot of people to make these houses work. They hire Melissa, they hire Joey, they hire the young lady who works out front. They hire the three of them as actors, but then who's shaking the wall earlier? Who's dropping that weird gargoyle type thing before the bathroom scene? They didn't hire other people to work this place, so it seemed odd to me as someone who has experience with these haunts.
What is probably missing? They don't have a story for their haunted house.
True.
They don't have a reason why this haunted house has all these clowns in it. And that's how you would start out.
Good point.
You would start telling the story about killer clowns who came here and killed all the people that lived in this place. And you have that all acted out as you go through. There then is the acting.
In general, I think the acting is good. I like Paul. I like Mac a lot. Him playing the straight man who just needs to get this stuff done. I like him as being protective of Sarah when they discover her standing off in the corner. He's not the one dating Sarah. Alex is. Alex, who's played by Danny Bellini. Bellini overdoes it in a couple of scenes. Whereas I'm not sure if maybe that's because he's attempting the backstory to the character and the situation they're in. Whereas Paul, who is much more laid back. Gore Abrams has that ability to just be laid back. And so maybe it's part Abrams, maybe it's part Paul, but I felt he was more believable than most of them, except when he comes back and he's playing spaced out Paul. That gets cheesy to me.
I think the acting works better when they're either angry at each other or they're arguing with each other, when they're under a lot of pressure. But when they are just normal everyday people or the emotions aren't as big, I think that's where it sometimes goes a little wrong. When a group of them go out to the field trying to decide whether they're going to stay or not, I felt that acting was very, very weak.
Mm-hmm. This is the scene that usually confuses people because they're like, what did Mac tell Tony in that moment that made Tony stick around?
I agree with that. I just assume that they told Tony he sunk all of his money in this.
Absolutely true.
There was one scene that I thought was rather interesting that they never really play out with. So maybe they didn't know what they had. It's the scene between Alex and Paul where Paul finds Alex talking to Melissa.
Yes.
And Alex doesn't want Paul there, which I didn't understand. It seems like a perfectly good thing to record until I realize Alex is trying to seduce Melissa and he doesn't want Paul recording that.
Is that what you thought? That's interesting.
The way Alex was talking to Melissa, his motivation didn't seem to be to give her more information.
You're not wrong. That's so interesting. I never looked at that scene that way before. I have never even had an inkling of that. So now I kind of want to go back and look at it again.
It should be noted, I think, that no one in the film has really gone on to anything.
Yeah.
And it's been 6 years because it was 2015. Most of them, all they've really done is the next two films. But even the actors who would have more time to do other stuff generally haven't gone on to anything. And some of this, I think, is that filmmakers who are starting out, a huge number of them start out making horror films. And the reason is they can often be incredibly inexpensive to make, especially if you come up with a good idea. But the problem is it's a two-edged sword. Then you have a very hard time not making horror films.
You get sort of pigeonholed.
And if the horror film is a success, like, for example, Blair Witch Project, they don't want you to make something else. They want you to make a sequel.
Right.
And then you sort of get stuck. It can be possible to get out of it, especially, I think, if you know going in, you have to get away from that as soon as possible, or this is all you'll ever be doing for them. And also, when you're a new filmmaker, you get whatever actor you can. And like in Kevin Smith's Clerks, the actors weren't very good, and none of them went anywhere.
Yeah, they just go with Kevin Smith films.
And they often have very small parts. Or unless he makes a sequel to Clerks, they just don't have anything much going for them. With that, here's some more information about the movie. At the beginning, the filmmakers were looking for an abandoned house to shoot in. But when they couldn't find anything they liked, they looked for a real haunted house attraction, and they settled on The Haunting at the Waldorf Hotel in Layton, Pennsylvania, run by Angie Moyer, who served as the film set designer. About halfway through the movie, when Paul and Tony find Sarah staring at a wall in the middle of the night, it appears she is speaking in tongues. The audio is actually a reversed clip of the actress saying, "When I got to the front door, the police were arriving."
Mm.
The eye trick that Joy does in the movie is his actual eye.
I figured it would be.
He has it between his fingers, but he tells people, "Don't try this."
No, thank God.
Producer Joe Bandelli is uncredited in the movie, but he plays Diane's cameraman throughout the film in interviews and the final sequence. Writer-director Stephen Cognetti is uncredited in the movie, but he plays the cameraman with the tour group in the main sequence of the movie. And then, as you said, a sequel, Hell House LLC 2, The Abandoned Hotel, was released exclusively on Shudder on September 20th, 2018. A second sequel, Hell House LLC 3, Lake of Fire, was released in September 2019. And you mentioned that there's a prequel coming out?
Yeah, The Abaddon Tapes. They're still working on that one.
With that, let's get to my selection, and that is Man Bites Dog.
Yes.
First, some information about the film. Man Bites Dog is a Belgian black comedy crime mockumentary film released in 1992. It was written, produced, and directed by, and forgive me, Remy Balvaux, André Boncel, and Benoît Poelvoorde. Benoît will usually be referred to as Ben throughout the rest of the podcast. It stars Benoît Poelvoorde, Valérie Parent, Remy Balvaux, André Boncel, Jean-Marc Chenu, Alain Opezi, Vincent Tavier. The film revolves around a young documentarian and his crew making a film about a serial killer with the killer's full support. At first, they try to stay dispassionate, but eventually find themselves caught up in the savagery of the killer and help him with his killers. I would like to start off with talking about that title. I've always wondered why they chose that title. It's not the original title. The original is C'est arrivé près de chez vous, which literally means it happened near your home.
Mm-hmm.
But somewhere along the line, somebody thought they needed a new title, which I agree. I don't think It Happened Near Your Home would have been a great title for a film in the U.S. And they chose Man Bites Dog. It's a phrase in journalism that revolves around what sort of news stories are covered. The more unique and original the story, the more likely it is to get coverage. So a dog biting a man is ignored because that happens all the time. But a man biting a dog is so unusual, it'll be reported in the media. So you may have a different idea, but the best I can come up with is that the serial killings here are so common that they are no longer unique and original, and we desensitize ourselves to them, that they become a dog biting a man rather than a man biting a dog.
I completely agree with that. There's also maybe the element of the documentarians becoming part of the killing and becoming complicit in it themselves. I actually think that the original title would have worked. We have classics like When a Stranger Calls and The Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes. Wordy title, I don't think is a problem, but I think this idea of a pseudo true crime film coming out under It Happened in Your Neighborhood or whatever it was specifically, I think that could have worked. I think Man Bites Dog is a silly title. It's almost like those bad translations that you sometimes get.
Right. I do think it has the advantage of being memorable. I would have liked to be in the room where they're talking, well, we need an American title for this, Man Bites Dog. And I would think everybody would say, what? What do you think of the pairing of the two films?
I loved it. I thought it was very interesting. I hadn't seen this before.
Had you heard of it?
I don't think so, which is surprising to me because the time it came out, I would have been definitely too young to see it. Yeah, I was in middle school when it came out. My parents definitely would not have seen it, especially because it's not an English language spoken film and my parents are not into that kind of thing. I'm kind of surprised that in the film classes I took in college, it didn't come up, especially being somewhat contemporary for the time. But as a person who is interested or intrigued by the dark psychology of people and serial killers and true crime, I am surprised I didn't know it because this is definitely the kind of thing that should have been on my radar.
So you just recently saw the film then, I take it?
Yes.
What did you think of it?
I enjoyed it. I thought it was funny because I just keep coming back to IMDb and the first category of it is comedy. And I'm like, all right, this works for me. I kept asking myself during the film, why do they keep filming these killings? They're complicit. They're accessories. Why does this keep happening? And my brain, for some reason, refused to answer it until later on where I'm like, okay, it's because they didn't survive it. And I just found it so interesting. And I was explaining it away for Ben more than I was for the crew, in that he was such a narcissist that he was happy to be filmed, because I'm the killer you selected to film, because of course I am. And how full of himself he is regarding his culture, his artistic knowledge, but at the same time, he's so sloppy in the way he kills people. I found that fascinating. When he yells at the old woman in order to freak her out so that she had a heart attack and he didn't have to waste a bullet, he's like, well, this is much better for the neighbors. I said, the neighbors just heard you scream at her. I'm like, what's the difference?
As for me, I did see the film when it opened. I was both appalled and laughing hysterically.
And then appalled that you're laughing.
Yes, it's an endless cycle. But it was one of my favorite films of the year. I should say that when I was trying to decide what film to pair with Hell House, when I did research, this came up as a found footage film. But I didn't remember it being one and was puzzled by that, but decided to go with it anyway. And then when I rewatched it for the show, well, technically it is, because end, all the filmmakers are dead. So someone had to get all this footage together.
Yep.
When we talk about who did it and why, that isn't fully answered. Though at the same time, a lot of the editing had already been done, because they show you at one point where they're editing it along the way when Ben is looking at an attempted killing that he didn't succeed in.
And he's going through looking at it like a football coach.
Yeah.
Trying to review his plays. I thought that was brilliant.
What are some of your favorite scenes?
My absolute favorite part was when they're in some ramshackle old building and they encounter another film crew following a different serial killer. That is the best thing I've ever seen, and I wish I could have been in the room when they came up with the idea, because I thought that was hilarious. I was like, of course there would be such a thing. He's all excited. He's like, oh, do you see his camera? He's got a bigger camera. Yeah, well, he's using video. I'm using film. Oh, well, then let's destroy this camera. And it's like, oh, you guys do the same thing. You must know each other. You don't. What do you mean you don't? It's like, well, do you know this other killer? Like, it's just such a wonderfully absurd moment. It absolutely brought me joy.
Well, I guess great minds think alike, because yes, that is my favorite scene. It is the highlight of it. The movie as a whole is not just a comedy about a serial killer. It's also a satire and comedy, and we'll get into this a bit more, about new filmmakers and new filmmakers trying to find something different and interesting to make a film about. So here we have two groups of filmmakers who decided to focus on the same thing, a serial killer. And yes, and then they kill the other.
Yes.
The other documentary crew. It's not just Ben who kills them. It's also the documentary crew kills their counterpart as.
And thankfully, they destroy the camera, because then their found footage film can't get out before Ben's.
Yes. Here are two different reviews of the film, and it might be interesting to get your response. On one side, we have Kenneth Turan from the Los Angeles Times. And this was a controversial film when it was released. But Kenneth Turan highly praised the film upon its release. He said, "Man Bites Dog defines audacity, an assured, seductive chamber of horrors. It marries nightmare with humor and then abruptly takes the laughter away. Intentionally disturbing, it is close to the last word about the nature of violence on film, a troubling, often funny vision of what the movies have done to our souls." But Stephen Holden of the New York Times called the film a grisly, sick joke of a film that some will find funny, others simply appalling. The film gets carried away with its own cleverness and makes the audience the butt of a nasty, practical joke.
So I would argue that they're both right in particular places. It definitely defines audacity. It definitely puts it right out there. And it talks about that whole desensitization element. I would pair this with A Clockwork Orange. What it reminded me of was the rape scene in both of these and how uncomfortable it is to watch. And so how we have this element of we're desensitized to it, but yet we continue to go see these films. We continue to say, this is what we want. We're appalled by it, but at the same time, we're laughing at it, exactly what you experienced. This idea that for some reason we're able to hold back on our disgust and look at it and say, well, this is entertainment, or, oh, this is art. And I think to a point that second reviewer refuses to accept extremity as a kind of art. And I think it does make the audience the butt of a joke. It's one death after another death after another death after another death, and the serial killer is absolutely laughing at it. He gets called out for not going after big enough fish, and he goes, why the hell would I do that, right? Like, he says, I'm fine with my little fish. I'm making money. I'm doing what I need to do. I don't need to be on anybody's radar. But the very essence of being a serial killer is so that you can be famous and get caught, most of them. A lot of them, the narcissism of it and the calling card of a serial killer is because they want people to know that this is their work. That's why most of them get caught eventually. I feel like I'm devolving into four or five different things.
Well, no, we'll actually bring that part of it up again later on. But when it comes to these two quotes, I'm a little caught between the two.
And yeah, I am too.
It may depend on what you think the filmmaker's goals are and how aware they were of what they were doing. These are these people's first feature length film. They're all new filmmakers fresh out of film school. So you need to do something to make a splash.
And that's the truth.
They come up with this because it was shocking. And it's shocking for another reason, that it was shocking and that it would put them on the map. Or were they fully aware that they were actually trying to say something? Or is it both? And that's probably the question that comes up. Is what they're doing from an intellectual and aesthetic aspect done on purpose, or did they care? They just wanted to make a film that was going to shock people and put them on the map. And it also could be both.
Yeah, I'm vacillating back and forth. As I look at it and I say, okay, well, maybe it is just for shock value, because why do we need him running naked on a beach? The NC-17 rating alone makes you start questioning what they're looking for, because if it was to get money and to make sure people saw their film, they would have edited that stuff out. Yet it is in this film. Was it released in a censored version?
Not in the U.S. I do have a mention of it later on, that it was edited down when it was released to Blockbuster, because Blockbuster Video would not carry NC-17 titles.
Correct. They won't. Yeah, because I worked there. Obviously, you're dealing with a different rating system outside the U.S. Were they making the film hoping the U.S. would pick it up and it would go international? This is 92. It's known for being very gritty. The end of the 80s was very gritty. You already had Kubrick with Clockwork Orange. Most films of his can get pretty violent. Full Metal Jacket and elements of The Shining. I don't know.
Well, whatever you might say about that aspect of it, I think it is extremely well done, technically and aesthetically.
Yes, I agree with you there.
The direction was by Belvo, Bonsall, and Paul Vord, or Ben, who also shot it, edited it, acted in it. And it is quite, I think, lovely to look at. The black and white cinematography.
There's a lot of great framing of various things in there, too, for sure.
Right. It is a movie that was produced on a shoestring budget by four student filmmakers about a movie being produced on a shoestring budget by four student filmmakers.
Cinema verite.
Yes. And the screenplay also, you mentioned it before, and you're right. Ben is not a typical serial killer. He kills anyone and everyone. It's often unclear why, but his primary motive does seem to be money.
Mm-hmm.
And he has that scene about, well, we really want to go after old people and pensioners because everybody expects them to die and they always have money hidden somewhere in their house. But yes, he doesn't have the typical motivation of a serial killer, as you said. His subjects are random, though he likes to start off each month with the postman so he can steal money from what's in the bag. Even though he's not out to make headlines, he's just thrilled to be the subject of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So there are also aspects of this, like Hell House LLC. You might be asking these questions, but it's so well made that you don't really get distracted. But as you said, he just does it so openly, it's almost impossible to believe that he hasn't gotten caught.
Yes, exactly. It's crazy that it takes as long as it does. And it's only because the quarry's been drained.
I think he's arrested for only one particular killing, and then he escapes. So, and then, of course, he dies, so they don't find out while he's killing that he actually is killing. And he does it in broad daylight, and I mean, he does it in alleyways and things like that.
In broad daylight, loud. He doesn't try to be slick about anything. He's yelling for the kid in the forest when the kid gets away from him.
Yes, that was a particularly terrifying scene when you kill children.
Exactly.
There was a time you never did that. First time I ever saw a child be killed on screen was Mad Max.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have Assault on Precinct 13 where a kid just, and I went, oh, well, that's new. Never seen that on film before. But
pushes the absurd level. That's what does it, this over-the-top, uber-violent story palatable. Because
right.
you're already laughing at the absurdity of the individuals, so then when they do the things, you're giggling already, so it's less shocking.
Ben is also a very interesting character because he thinks that he knows everything about everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the more you listen to him, the more you go, God, I would hate to be sat next to him at a dinner table.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely true.
He is this really quite fascinating and fun character. There are some screenwriters who, for some reason, think that your central character has to be someone that you would want to have dinner with. And I'm going, no. One of the great things about films is you can have dinner with someone you would never want to have
right.
dinner with in real life.
And I love an unlikable main character.
Benoit Poelvoorde, who played Ben, he became big. He's about the only person involved with this film.
Yeah, he's got quite the list.
He does. And he often played the same sort of person. He played a shallow know-it-all who was also a sore loser with a temper. And he sort of made a career of that. But he also played other characters. But the others really didn't. To show just how much of a low budget this film was, the person who played Ben's mother is actually his mother, and the person who played his grandparents are actually his grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have any idea what the story was about, that the footage was going to be used in a film in which Ben is a serial killer.
That's awesome.
And his mother was shocked when she was taken to see her son behind bars because she had no idea.
I think that's hilarious.
Yeah. But the other two main ones, Andre Bonzel's last film was in 2012. He only made a handful. Remy Balveau committed suicide in 2006. So out of all of these, he is the one who made it big.
That's a shame.
I do think that this is a good movie for new filmmakers to study, perhaps even more so than Hell House LLC, which is a lot more of a difficult movie to make in many ways, technically. This one was made for little money. They used relatives of the central character. Everybody did everything. They acted in it. They edited it. They directed it. They shot it. It took a year because they kept running out of money, and they would get more, and then they would keep shooting. And the concept is one that would allow for this sort of shoot. You could spread over a year. So they came up with a good idea.
And work it into the actual plot where like that's exactly what was happening to them. They kept running out of money. So they needed to keep killing people in order to fund the project itself.
Right. Yeah, they're running out of film. They're running out of this. They have to replace technicians.
Twice.
Killed in both cases, mocking filmmakers and their self-importance. Remy says the first time, we'll really miss him. He was so important to this. This film is dedicated to him and his girlfriend. Who was carrying his child. And then the second time they're killed, he says, well, we will really miss him. And this film is dedicated to him and his girlfriend who is carrying his child.
And it's the same woman.
Yes.
I was like, wait a minute.
And then it ends, as you say. We don't know who actually finally put all this film together.
It's probably the girlfriend.
They were working on it as well, but the police would have found the last bit of film.
That's true.
I think that is an issue here as to who actually finally put it all together, since nobody survived.
So I noticed while I was watching it, and it makes me worry a little bit about myself sometimes, not actually, but, you know, when he was testing them at that Christmas time when they were at the bar and he was joking about the drink and he was testing them on how much weight you need to put on a child's body.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, oh, yeah, it's 4 times his weight. And then they said it was 2. And he thought that was correct. And I went, oh, thank God, I didn't remember it. And then I looked up the goofs. And it turns out that it is a goof. It's an error. And I was like, damn it, I did remember. It's the first time I've seen this movie. And I remembered that detail.
Yeah, there's something off here. And I also do want to point out another highlight of the film that is so appalling and so funny. When they kill the black character.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
And his incredible racism, like Archie Bunker, we're both reacting in horror and find ourselves complicit in.
Yes.
Because we're also laughing at the stereotype.
It's like watching Gran Torino.
Right.
When you're laughing in the theater at this string of horrific slurs that Clint Eastwood character releases. And you're just like, what is happening? And again, it's this overkill, literally and figuratively, in Man Bites Dog.
The whole movie tries to make you complicit in everything. If you enjoy this movie, there's something as wrong with you as there is with the characters involved.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy it, so I guess there is something as wrong with me.
And that's just it. It's the same thing for me. It's this idea of dark psychology films, and I keep watching them, and I keep enjoying them.
Well, with that, here's some more information about the film. It cost 1 million francs to make, or $33,000, and it made $205,569 in the U.S. alone. Don't have any information for how well it did anywhere else, but it seems like it did very well. It was screened at the 1992 Cannes Film Festival. It won the International Critics Prize, the SACD Award for Best Feature, and the Special Award of the Youth for the three directors. The film received the André Cavens Award for Best Film by the Belgium Film Critics Association, and since its release, the picture has become a cult film. It isn't shown very much. I'm not sure I've ever seen it in theaters.
No, I haven't
since
either.
It came out. It is on Criterion. They do have a Criterion release. Because of the content of extreme violence, the film was banned in Sweden. In 2003, the video was banned in Ireland. And then it received a rare NC-17 rating for the U.S. release. And as we also said, R-rated version of the film is made for blockbusters. The scenes where Ben and the crew work together to kill a child are removed. And the scenes where Ben rapes a woman and the camera crew joins in are included but edited down to have less nudity and gore. Ben's cocktail, Petit Gregory, is a reference to a murder case in France that involved the killing of the 4-year-old Gregory, who was found floating in a river with his hands and legs tied. Much like the olive in the cocktail that is tied to a sugar cube. The murder case was covered very thoroughly by the media. And I believe there is a Netflix documentary.
There is.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
And I saw it.
And when he brought it up, I went, wait a minute, I know that one.
Yeah, I didn't recognize it until I read this and said, oh yes, I remember that docuseries. Paul Vord became a member of the Cannes Film Festival jury in 2004 by request of Quentin Tarantino, a big fan of Man Bites Dog, that's a big surprise, who had presided over the jury that year. On February 4th, 1998, Remy Belvaux was in a 4-person gang alongside Noel Godin and Jean Bouquet, all of whom were fined for throwing a cream pie in the face of the American businessman and Microsoft founder Bill Gates.
Oh.
On a visit to Brussels at the time.
Interesting.
So with that, let's start closing out. And I asked you to choose a film or two to go with your choice that might interest our audience.
I actually have four. For people who enjoy haunted house documentary sorts of films, found footage, Grave Encounters is usually one that comes up quite a bit. I recently came upon on Shudder a film called The Cleansing Hour, which is actually really cool because that's the computer format that I was talking about earlier. That one's kind of cool because it's about these guys who run a YouTube series called The Cleansing Hour where they run fake exorcisms. The person who's supposed to show up doesn't, so they put one of their girlfriends to pretend that she's possessed, but she's actually possessed. And then there's an amazing found footage, home movie investigation kind of film called Lake Mungo, which is really big in the horror community. I think more people need to see it. With this family whose daughter has gone missing, they're trying to investigate, but then there's these ghostly videos and ghostly images that start turning up. But they also have As Above, So Below, but I feel like that one is known. But that's the French Connection, the one where they're in the caverns in Paris. They find a gate to hell.
Well, I'm going with three serial killer comedies and one found footage film.
I love it.
Monsieur Verdoux is Charlie Chaplin's 1957 masterpiece about a bluebeard who marries many women at the same time, then murders them for their money. It also co-stars Martha Ray as a wife who just won't die. Alec Guinness plays 8 roles in Robert Hamer's 1949 Kind Hearts and Coronets. He plays the whole Descoigne family being killed off one by one by a distant relative who is trying to get rid of every family member who stands between him and his becoming the Duke and inheriting their fortunes. Rod Steiger, on the other hand, sort of plays many roles in 1968's No Way to Treat a Lady as a serial killer who dons disguises for each murder. This co-stars George Segal and Lee Remick. And for my found footage, Lucky Bastard from 2014 is unusual in that it's not a horror film. In it, a man wins the opportunity to have sex on film with his favorite porn star. But when he can't perform and is made fun of, he goes on a murder spree.
Egad, I got to get my hands on that one.
What is next? What should we be expecting from you?
You can catch me on Between the Scares, which is a podcast I do with Jason Soto, where we are watching every film that Jason Blum and Blumhouse Productions have put out there. We have finally reached the point where we're doing horror films, because his first few were not horror films, and they also weren't good. We recently just released an episode out of sequence because Halloween Kills was released, so we did put out an episode about that. And we're going to be working on some of the Welcome to the Blumhouse films on Prime, because it's October and we need to do our horror movie thing. You can also catch me and my brother Mark on the Sib List, that's S-I-B-L-I-S-T, on which we have four different lists that we're working through, and every choice is random. Two of our lists are our individual lists of doom, which we have populated with films that we have been avoiding for one reason or another, and our next episode is my list of doom, and my dirty film nerd secret is about to be brought to an end, the end of an era. I am finally going to see Schindler's List, which is amazing, right? It's supposed to be a brilliant film, but I've been avoiding it because I just don't want to sit and watch a movie that's going to destroy me. And then we will be skewing our randomizer a bit. We're going to take all of the horror movies from the fill-in filmography, and we're going to randomize those to get episode 10 for first milestone episode in October to do a horror movie.
Fantastic. I'll go through my usual litany. I'm a screenwriter and script consultant, and you can find more information about that on my Howard Kastner Screenplay consultation page on Facebook. My blog is called Rantings and Ravings, and there I explore issues on film and screenwriting. I have published two books of short stories on Amazon, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion. These are sci-fi, supernatural, and fantasy short stories. I've also published the second edition of my screenwriting book, My Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader, and I'm an amateur photographer, and you can find those on Instagram. The previous podcast was with filmmaker David Au, where we talked Ang Lee's The Wedding Banquet and Ozu's Late Spring, what we called matchmaking Asian style. Next up will be with The Vern of Cinema Recall, where we will discuss George Romero's Dawn of the Dead and Bertrand Bonello's Nocturama, both films about people trapped in a mall.
I like that pairing. That's great. Trapped in a mall.
So with that, Lisa, I want to thank you very much for being a guest on my show.
It's always a pleasure, Howard. Thank you so much for having me back.